ebook publishers and marketing services company, Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, your favorite fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes, PRX, and right here locally on KSKQ 89.5 FM, Ashland, Oregon, art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $9.99 per month. And be sure to check out our new book rental program. That's Downpour.com. On this episode, the highly anticipated interview with New Zealand band Ivy Blue, best-selling novelist Martin Lestrap's Hold On Fiction Can Only Be Topped by Stephen King, and Nightfall by New York Times best-selling author Nelson DeMille, in our Downpour.com special feature right after the news you want to know.
Hi, I'm Sean Mark Nipper.
I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro. And this just in, Generalissimo Francisco Franco is still dead.
On other news.
And I'm Maya Seligman. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. Something that a lot of people travel to Ashland for is the annual Ashland Independent Film Festival.
I love that
and
thing, man.
I had the joy of going to that this month. It was my ninth year volunteering and attending. And one of the films that played was something that got a lot of great reviews. And actually, my mom, who traveled here from Berkeley, she saw films with me all 5 days. She said one of her favorite films was Kurt Cobain, Montage of Heck. This is a documentary about the Nirvana singer, musician, Kurt Cobain. And 21 years ago this month, he actually took his life. It was in April 1994. And this is the first authorized documentary about this rock hero. And it's being released now in different venues. And it is done by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Brett Morgan, who also worked with Cobain's daughter, Frances Bean Cobain, who's 22 years old. She acted as the executive producer.
For and the kid stays in the picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what they worked on?
That is right.
Cool, man.
Yeah, talented. And I can tell you, I really want to see the film because I didn't get a chance to see it for the film festival. But it sounds fascinating because basically the project started 8 years ago in 2007 when the singer's widow, Courtney Love, she approached him, Brett Morgan, about making a film because a film had never been made. And so when he said yes, she brought him crates and boxes containing all of Kurt's stuff and just told him, go ahead. And so there were no restrictions placed on him whatsoever. Courtney didn't end up seeing anything until the end. So the fascinating part is it contains not only the look at his creativity with music, but he also did journals and home videos and audio tracks and audio diaries. All sorts of stuff. Recording, it shows him from a really young age, like from being a kiddo. And I thought this is a fascinating way of looking at Kurt Cobain, his legend, his legendary appeal that has still gone on today, even after this long after his death. And Frances Bean, his daughter, she, at the end of the film, she turned to the producer, Morgan, and she said, thank you. You've given me 2 hours with my dad I've never had.
I did see it at the Ashland Film Festival.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was
You know, I like his music, and he was a really, really big rock star. And of course, you know, when you die tragically like Jim Morrison or any of the others, you know, that are young, the myth gets even bigger and bigger, right? And but when you see this movie, you know, one of the things that you walk away from is that you see him as a man, not as a rock god. You know, like the movie they made about the Doors, and they made several of them. They always paint out Jim Morrison to be as a shaman, a rock god, and everything like that. They never show, you know, the real Jim Morrison. You know, the one that you would only know if you knew him personally.
Right, the doubts and the humanity.
Right, and in this film, you know, Kurt Cobain just comes across as a young guy who happens to be a successful musician, and he wasn't in the beginning. And you see a lot of home films, you know, of him singing to his daughter as she's a baby mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And it was, you know, it was really, really well put together. And the other guys from Nirvana were in it. Dave Grohl wanted to be in it, but time constraints, he was on tour. He couldn't be in it, and he had real regrets about not being in there. He wanted to be in part of the movie because he was a big part of his life.
Yeah.
And Frances Bean was there, his daughter. They were talking to her. She was there with her mother, and they've had a strained relationship. Somebody asked her about, you know, your dad was such a legend. He made such beautiful music and stuff like that. And she kind of laughed, which is, you know, not characteristic of her because she's always like on the goth dark side. And she goes, you know what? I didn't know my father, you know? And she goes, but I will tell you this. I don't like his music.
And
everybody's going, you know, but he's a legend, you know? He's good Kurt Cobain, you know, he's Nirvana, you know? But she made a perfect point. She goes, you know what? How many people love the music that their parents listen to?
True.
You know,
very true.
I'm 22 years old. You know, grunge rock just isn't my thing.
You know,
it makes me feel lucky that my mom, like, she loves Nirvana. It's like, oh, that's interesting. I think it's a little atypical.
Yeah, because for you and I and Cyrus, we're all around the same. That was kind of our era, high school, mm-hmm. college. You know, we were all there for grunge, you know, in that developmental stage. The thing I find interesting about this, you know, was a quote, actually, that Morgan said. What he talked about, he said, I didn't make this film for the fans. I made it for Frances.
Yeah, and Frances, actually, she was pretty liberated in knowing that her dad loved her and that his suicide was nothing to do with her.
That's awesome.
Right. And that's a whole different quagmire too, you know, when he died and all of a sudden, you know, there wasn't social media.
Yeah.
So we had to take everything, you know, as.
Yeah. TMZ wasn't on the scene 10 minutes later.
Right. And you're right though. You know, he did become, you know, very successful and he had the downside of fame is like, you know, having a lot of money, which, you know, makes you able to indulge in things that maybe aren't so healthy for you. But then there's also the downside that he never lived long enough, you know. And, you know, some people make a lot of money and lose a lot of money. And I think Jerry's got something he wants to tell us about that.
Exactly. Well, one of the stories that I've been looking at is the story of another musician, Dee Snider. You guys know Twisted Sister?
Yeah,
you know,
Twisted
we're
Sister,
not
yeah.
gonna take. Yeah. Twisted Sister came on the scene late in the glam hair metal band era. They wore makeup, they looked like girls, long hair, you know, that whole thing, which for him was a blessing and a curse because they were successful with their first album. But then that was kind of around the time that grunge started coming around in bands like Nirvana and the societal shift happened. And he was never able to capture that same success that he had with We're Not Going to Take It. Recently, he was met with Oprah Winfrey on her Where Are They Now? One of those specials. And Snider had a year where he made $0. Oh, Stay Hungry was the first album, and that was a huge success, but their next album wasn't, and they basically just fell apart. Nobody wanted to hear him, and he was forced at a young age, essentially, to have achieved massive fame, huge amounts of money, and then watch it all just go away. So he reinvented himself, and now Dee Snider is, you know, a loving family man. He's been living with a wife of 34 years, who he really credited with sticking with him through all of it. I saw him on The Celebrity Apprentice. It's like, oh my God, that's Dee Snider, and he really is grounded and happy to be a family man, and it's a pretty good story, really.
You know, the thing about Dee Snider, he produced a horror movie that was independent, and it played at the Ashland Film Festival. And that's what I was thinking about. A credit, you know, I think to him that, you know, you can achieve such highs and still, you know, keep your sense of humor, keep your family together. And, you know, I heard him on Oprah and he was talking about it. He goes, you know what? It was humbling. It was embarrassing. I was delivering like pizzas and people go like, dude, aren't you like D. Snyder?
Yeah, aren't you D. Snyder? Why are you delivering my pizza?
You owe me $5.50, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I would give him a big tip.
Yeah.
His day job now, he hosts a nationally syndicated radio show called The House of Hair. He's dabbled in some screenwriting. He did a musical, D. Snyder's Rock and Roll Christmas Tale. He was on a movie called Strangeland, and he's been on Broadway. He joined the cast of Rock of Ages in 2010. So you're not always going to get to the top and stay there. Snyder talked about that he thought it was a finish line. Like, oh, I've achieved success. I've got the money. And now it's all gravy from here. But it's not. It's a constant process. And it's good to see it not ending tragically.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yep.
And it's funny because, you know, one Father's Day, my children, who were no longer children, took me to go see a movie, That's My Boy, with Adam Sandler, right?
Uh-huh.
And in the movie, Adam Sandler, right, he's got these guys from the 80s when he grew up, right, coming in there like, you know, Todd Bridges and Vanilla Ice, right?
Yeah.
And Vanilla Ice works in the bowling alley and stuff like that. He goes, what are you working in the bowling alley for, man? He goes, I thought you had all those millions from Ice Ice Baby. He goes, man, I had to give all that money to the Queen.
Yeah, I didn't make anything. And that's basically the true story because he made no money off it when it was all said and done. Yeah.
Well, but yeah, he does that. Do it yourself TV show, you know, DIY,
do it yourself.
Yeah, Bronson Pinchot, one of our narrators, does one too.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Well, the first time I saw that, and then I heard him narrating a book, I was like, and there you go. There's a guy who achieves success at time and place, but it's not everybody's going to be Dustin Hoffman, you know, or Billy Joel or Brian Wilson.
Right.
Well, that's the great thing about reality shows is they can still be at least somewhat in the spotlight.
That's well, right, Brian. And I'm glad you brought up Brian Wilson, man. Because Holly's got an incredible story on Brian Wilson.
Heck yeah, man. No peer pressure on Brian Wilson. Oh, maybe there is. Brian Wilson is back with an evocative album, No Peer Pressure. Play on words, as it's P-I-E-R, pressure. It offers an ample reason to celebrate the extended solo career that's followed this Beach Boys journey. His 11th solo studio offering opens with This Beautiful Day, a short track that captures all of Wilson's yearning and desires in the simplest, most direct way, offset by lovely harmonies and fine trumpet work. That's a pretty interesting thing to hear that he's coming back around.
And he has a movie coming too, doesn't he, Charlie?
Yeah, he's got a movie coming out too. It'll be out in the first week of June. It's called Love and Mercy. It's a Brian Wilson story. And he was a singer and songwriter, founder of the Beach Boys. During the 60s, he flipped out on, you know, on drugs. And like he actually spent 2 years in his house never going out. He had sand imported into his house.
Wow.
He had sand imported into his house and had the piano put in there. So he had a feeling of being on the beach when he wrote songs. And, you know, it's just the whole thing is bizarre. He made it back. But I got the CD, you know, No Peer Pressure. And I got to tell you, every song on it is great. There's one song I really love, you know, it's called From the Island. And I know, Maya, you would love it, man, because it's done by She and Him, by Zooey Deschanel. Mm. You know, he's like, you know, I'm not just going to keep doing, you know, Surfer Girl or, you know, Good Vibrations. But you get the same melodic melodies. And now She and Him, he doesn't even sing on the song. You know, he just wrote it and he plays on it. But it's just such a cool little song. And he sings about maybe 5 tracks and he does harmonies on all of them. And then he has
Blondie Chaplin from the Beach Boys is playing with him.
Yeah, he's got Al Jardine from the Beach Boys playing with him. And they asked him, you know, why didn't bring the other people? He goes, I didn't want to make it a Beach Boy thing. I just wanted to do something that was fun. Now, he has an amazing story.
One of the things that always makes you think about is what could have been. You know, with musicians or actors that left us too soon kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I know one of the ones we've talked about on this show multiple times of kind of a favorite of ours is Jim Morrison. You know, we loved that his work. And you were talking about especially him just earlier Cyrus. On the show. Cyrus, you and I were talking earlier. Right. There's a new book?
Yeah, there is. You know, Jim Morrison, just like we've been talking about Brian Wilson and talking about Dee Snyder earlier too. You know, another front man, Jim Morrison, he was part of the 27 Club, like Kurt Cobain. You know, but there was like a human side to him that some people got to see. And he had a friend in Tony Funches. Tony is writing a book called The Ancestors Soundtrack, My Life with the Rolling Stones, The Doors, and More. He also worked with the Rolling Stones at Altamont, and he was Jim Morrison's bodyguard. In the book, he writes about the time he spent, personal time, talking about philosophy and poetry and stuff like that with Jim, and also a night out in L.A. where they went out to a bar. We're drinking heavily, of course, rumors and myths and everything, and, decided to retire their glasses in a fireplace and got kicked out. And then they went to another bar and did the same thing, and... And second bar, they got 86 for life. And, then Tony went back years later. This is all in his book. And the guy still owns the bar to this day and told him to get out.
No way. Really?
Yeah. And he was like, look, man, Jim Morris has been dead for a long time. And so the guy said, yeah, okay, well, just watch yourself. You can stick around. So, he's got a bunch of these crazy stories, about being with Jim and also things about the Rolling Stones. He's currently finishing up the book and running a crowdfunding campaign on GoFundMe. So if you can go on there, find Tony Funchess and help him out with this book. I guess there's a lot that goes into getting permissions, so you got to pay people to publish certain things in your book. So I guess that's kind of what goes along with this GoFundMe campaign.
That's hilarious.
That is hilarious. I'm looking at this and there's like Tony is recalling, some of the, bar 86s, the thing where he says, when the bartender tells him, you and your buddy need to be leaving, man. And, Morrison's reply was, my mother would skin me alive if she found me in this restaurant.
I love it because sometimes with celebrities, it's kind of like, or icons, I wish I could be a fly on the wall and just kind of like, gosh, I wonder what they'd be doing or what they'd be talking about. So it seems like that's a great vantage to be able to see that.
Okay, Jim Morrison, there's like this myth, this persona we're talking about, the shaman and all this, and you watch the Doors movie, and Kurt Cobain, it's like Kurt Cobain, like you saw it happen, you were like alive when he was alive, and so maybe that's why it doesn't hold the same mystique for me, somebody like Charlie, Jim Morrison probably doesn't have that mystique for you, you're like, I heard about him in the news. He was alive when I was alive. He's just some guy.
Dude, I saw Jim Morrison at Devinger Downs in Los Angeles before they even had a hit album out in college. And so you're right about that. That's a good point, man, because like a lot of these guys, I remember them, coming from the family that I come from in the entertainment industry. You meet them before they're famous. It's like all these people sitting in this room. Everybody met. And now everybody is a personality, and it's just like other people who don't know you would say like wow, man.
Yeah. You knew Jim Morrison.
So it's like
another guy.
Yeah, it's like Travis has the thing because about Jim Morrison but he just knows the myth. He was dead before he was even born.
Has anyone seen Veep? Yes.
I have.
Okay, I haven't seen it, but. For those of you who don't know, it's an HBO TV series, a political comedy, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and it's set in the office of Selina Meyer, and that's the fictional vice president who then becomes the first female U.S. president. And she did an interview with Katie Couric of Yahoo, and they talked about the upcoming 2016 elections, since, of course, there is a woman up for president. Hillary Rodham Clinton announced her candidacy for president last week. And there was an interesting story because what Julia was saying is that their show, Veep, it pushes the envelope in terms of reality on sometimes. But something that happened is in the first or second season, they had all this stuff. They had a story about emails getting out that she was, her character was leaked personal emails. Mm-hmm. Then it turns out that Hillary Clinton, she was criticized last month because it was revealed she was using her own private email account while she was
Secretary of State.
Secretary of State. And so it's interesting that story ended up matching out. So,
life imitating art.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's so bizarre, like a bizarre world, as Jerry likes to say, is that I saw that thing. And what's really interesting, when Maya was first starting the story, she goes, Katie Couric of Yahoo. And I was just like, because she's so famous as, you know, for being from, you know,
like AB, the, yeah, you know, one of the big
hosting the nightly news and all stuff, and then everyone's, you know, switching over to internet, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, that's crazy,
you know. And I saw part of that interview, and I found it interesting was she was talking about aging, you know, about the being an you know, aging on camera, because Seinfeld was what, 20 some odd years ago when that started. Am I right about that?
The 90s, yeah.
Yeah.
How's she carrying her age? Is she carrying her age with she looks great. Zest or with, you know,
she has said actually that getting older on camera is really weird. But something that I like is that she's embracing new opportunities in television for older women. Like, and she says that right now TV is so vast that as a result, it's bringing in lots of different creative people with whole, like, a range of different perspectives, different styles, different voices. And so that does include an older demographic of empowered women.
See, I love that, too, because there was a real, I want to say, an issue for a long time of basically actresses aging out. Like, that was a, you know, you were good in your 20s and into your 30s, and then when you hit 40, you were persona non grata. Like, I'll say right now, some of my favorite actresses working are older. Judi Dench, Helen Mirren. You know, when I see those actresses in movies, I'm on board. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I love that that trend is on the swing.
Betty White did both beautiful.
Sigourney Weaver.
Weaver.
Yeah, Sigourney Weaver. Oh, I just saw a great one with her, too. The Map of the World. It was from 99.
Yeah, Fantastic. Julia.
And Julia Lewis. With her. It was called Gods, was it Exodus, Gods and Kings.
Yeah.
I saw a great one where they were called Avatar.
Yeah, I wouldn't guess it because Julia looks young, but she's 54.
Yeah. So. Well, that's an amazing thing, too. I mean, Charlize Theron is in her 50s.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is in her 50s.
Yeah, well, they work out. Yeah, Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, too, right? Yeah. I mean,
you've got something there.
I think I might have something like there. That.
I've got something here.
What do you got?
Grace and Frankie, it takes a couple powerhouse actresses to handle this one, and Netflix has got it. Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, I fondly remember both of them from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. They're reuniting. Yeah. They're reuniting for Grace and Frankie, a comedy in which they play women who learn during a double date dinner that their husbands are in love with each other.
Really?
That kicks off the five stages of Grace and Frankie, as the trailer dubs it. It's shock, confusion, rage, reflection, as the women lean on each other with plenty of sniping at and mocking of along the way. Dealing with these life-shattering changes, Martin Sheen and Sam Waterston are the two actors that play the husbands. And they're not only in love, but they plan to divorce their wives and marry each other.
Oh, which, man.
My God, we live in the greatest time ever.
And Dolly Parton will be the officiant.
That's right.
Yeah, that is so funny because, you know, everybody knows who Martin Sheen is because, you know, I think he has a couple famous sons.
Yeah. And he's done a few things himself, too.
Yeah, he's done a few things himself, too. But for all our listeners, I'm sure we don't know who Sam Waterston is, but I think Law & Order.
Yeah, he was the DA on Law & Order starting in season 2.
He was the attorney. And so, I saw a clip of this thing, and I was just like, oh, my God, because you never would picture these two guys as being gay.
Holly, thank you so much. I had no idea this was coming, and it is now officially the thing I'm looking forward to the most in the world.
Oh, yeah, and the creator was Marta Kaufman and Home Improvement producer Howard Morris. So you got to figure that you're going to get a load of laughs in there. There's going to be all 13 episodes will be available on May 8th, it says, in addition to 4 Emmy winners in the lead roles. It also stars Ethan Embry and Baron Vaughn, Joe Morton, Jeff Stoltz, Ernie Hudson, and Barry Bostwick.
Ernie Hudson and Barry Bostwick? Oh, my God.
And that's in season 1. So now you know, Jerry Renfro.
How?
And everyone else out there.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm stunned.
You're going to binge watch when it comes out.
I think literally several of my brain cells just committed suicide.
Yeah, well, it doesn't just stop there. I mean, another show that we all used to watch and love, Coach.
What?
Yeah, it's going to be back on primetime. I mean, it's unreal. All these shows finding rebirth on TV, and because of Hulu and all this, Netflix, they got another 13 episodes coming up. We all remember Craig T. Nelson as Hayden Fox, our favorite football coach for the Minnesota State University Screaming Eagles.
That's right.
Yes. So, you know, and then later it became an expansion team. Yeah, so, you know, a lot of exciting things here. And it's not going to be on ABC. It's going to be on NBC. But, yeah, Craig's coming back. He's going to be the executive producer as well. And Barry Kemp, the creator of the original series, is back to write. Going to be a lot of fun to see these guys back on TV. I remember watching this series along with, like, Twin Peaks and X-Files and all that. You know, it was cool because, you know, I played football in high school and, you know, it was nice to see kind of like the inside of the coach's locker room, you know, and like what's going on that side of the ball, you know, on TV.
This is so great. And I'll tell you this, you know, stuff like that and the crowdfunding for the, you know, the Veronica Mars movie has proven that a strong fandom can get this stuff brought back, you know, and I think that's fantastic because in the past, we've been just at the whims of executives and frankly, Nielsen, you know, and I read a recent report that the Nielsen company is disputing the claim that people are cutting cable and going straight to online. I think stuff like this shows that they're paying attention to what the people want, you know, giving us stuff because those, you know, Craig T. Nelson's still around. We love that character. Right. If you've got stories to tell, give it to us. We will consume it. This is fantastic. I mean, X-Files, Twin Peaks, Coach.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing
is Arrested Development.
Arrested Development. I mean, they just keep happening. You know, another thing that's probably helping with a lot of this, and Sean, you might know a little bit more, is, you know, the production of, you know, you can get a high quality film, you know, at a bargain price nowadays. You know, back in the 50s or something, you had these enormous cameras, you got to be in a studio, huge, you know, lights and everything, you know, just to produce something like I Love Lucy.
Yeah,
you can go out with an iPhone on location and you get this great film quality. And so, you know, that would also might be a part of what's helping, you know, with all this production going on. Huh?
Totally. Yeah,
it was huge barriers to entry. It was like a huge commitment. It took a huge commitment of time and resources. And now, like you said, you know, you could film on an iPhone. I mean, hopefully they don't do that, but, you know, it's a lot less.
Well, the crazy thing is I give a lot of people crap for using a phone to film stuff. But these days I have the iPhone 6 Plus. It's ridiculous. Some of the stuff you can do, the slow motion on there is filters, phenomenal. And the time lapse is so cool. I used that just the other day. And I say, people, if you're going to do it, you know, do it right. What did they have? They had Bentley did a commercial with the iPhone.
Oh, wow.
It was filmed with an iPhone?
Yeah. Well, they had $100,000 worth of gear and production wrapped around it.
But they used the iPhone as the camera.
Exactly. So
I think one of the great things is this shows that it doesn't have to be one or the other, that we will consume shows like Daredevil, we will consume shows filmed on an iPhone, but we also still want the big production value, A-list stars, you know, that there's a market for all of that.
There was just recently a show that was on Vimeo. It was a podcast, not a podcast, but just a regular, you know, channel that people had. Mm-hmm. It's about, I think it's about selling weed, actually. Yeah, totally. But HBO actually picked it up. So.
Oh, wow.
Well, maybe we should do a Get Behind Me Now, Stay There kind of show.
The show, yes.
Yeah, so right.
Exactly,
each other.
We should start filming this.
Yeah. I was one of those people gifted with a face for radio, so I
think. Wait, my mom told me that.
Just imagine you can only hear his voice, you can't see his face.
Yeah, well, I'll try to find my voice doppelganger.
Wait, I think I had
is Art with Holly Lorien Adams.
This is Holly Lorien Adams, and time is art. What does that mean to you? Is it possible that life could be lived as a masterpiece? Is it possible that we can find inspiration in the mundane? Perhaps it is that you have a beautiful garden outside that you look at every morning and you see it blossoming from moment to moment. Is it possible that that could be perceived as art? Is the golden ratio of life really before you in every given moment? Is it possible that maybe you could see life as thriving in an artful way? Perhaps time is art.
And that's your art and entertainment news.
Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
Alternative rock band Ivy Blue continues to release hit albums from their home in New Zealand, with money going to the World Vision charity. They talk about it with the president of Just Imagine Inc., Charlie Stanton, in this interview.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting edition of Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. We have a really great treat for you today. We have on Ivy Blue. They are from New Zealand. They're in the alternative rock pop era. So, hey, welcome to the show. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you for finally having us.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's our pleasure, man. You know, it's hard to, even in this day of technology, sometimes it's hard to do things, you know, globally.
Yeah.
One of the things I really like about what you've done, you have an album out, you know, World Magnetic, you know, by Ivy Blue. And, you know, 50% of your sales go to the charity World Vision. I mean, how cool is that? You guys right off the bat are saying, you know, we're setting the tone here. We're not just here to entertain you. You know, we're here to help everybody, too.
Thing is, the politicians can make as much noise as they want. People over in Africa, God bless them and God pray for them, they can make as much noise as they want, but unless people can substantially come on board, there's not much of a difference. I mean, my family sponsors a child, but when me and the Flo were talking about how something we could do for them as a result of the Reverb Nation things, we said, okay, we'll put 50% of stuff aside and we'll just give it to World Vision, who really need the money.
You know, and that's a beautiful thing that you're doing, and I wish more artists would do that. I know some of them have tried in the past. What ended up happening is, like, they would make huge amounts of money, but by the time they split it up with promoters and films and all this other stuff, you know, the people that actually needed the help got very, very little.
Exactly. That's why we try and keep out as many costs as possible.
Beautiful. Listen, you know, do you have a favorite song? I ask everybody this, if they have a favorite song, and I always get the standard answer. So, you know, James, don't feel embarrassed if you tell me the same thing. They always say the one I'm working on right now.
Let me ask you another question. Do you have a favorite child?
The one I'm working on right now.
No, with us, we don't have favorites. We write a song, we do the best we can, but ultimately, it's the people in the sales and the critics who are going to decide if it's any good or if it's their favorite. It's more or less, once we finish it, it becomes everybody's song. We don't really go, oh, this is our favorite. Although we have favorites that we like to play, there's no particular favorite song among the two of us. I can only please one person a day.
Yeah, no, it's like, you know, I'm looking at your songs, like, you know, Forever December, you know, The Wanderer, you know, Interlude, you know, I mean, like, there's got to be a song, you know, that I'm thinking that you guys either, one, you know, when you wrote it, you were like, man, this is just gold, I love it, or one that you wrote is like, you know, I like it, it's a good little rocker, but I'll tell you what, even though it's not my favorite song, I love performing it.
Well, Forever December and The Wanderer and Carrie Ann, they came at a very painful time in my own life, and this was long before the group got together, because me and Flo, we used to play together in other bands before we connected as Ivy Blue, and there was a period where there was some really messy personal stuff. We don't need to name it exactly, but there were some songs that came out of that, of which The Wanderer, Forever December, and Carrie Ann actually came from. They came from a personal struggle. We find you write the best hits when you just don't try to write a pop hit. I mean, the ones like Miley Cyrus and everything. They try and write the hits. Sometimes they kind of aren't hits. The best hits come when you're not trying to write them. Those songs, I just really put my head into pen, really.
So what's your most challenging thing to do when you're recording? Is it, you know, the songwriting, the actual mixing, or is it performing live?
Well, I guess each one has its difficulties. Playing live, you get to amend the songs a bit, but you only get one shot at each song every night.
Right.
When you're in a recording studio, and I'm coming to you actually from my bedroom where all those albums were actually made, you can nip and tuck everything. You can go over it again, but it's also quite hard to rein your ideas in sometimes. So they've both got their difficulties. It's more or less how difficult each one comes. That and also the difficulty would be trying to get some decent effects on my pedals without too many issues.
Okay, so I'm going to give you the choice. Forever, December, The Wanderer, Interlude. Which one of those three songs would you like us to play? Because we're going to cut in a song right here, and what do you think would be the best? Or do you have a different choice?
The current single is Forever, December, so why not get the current single out there? Just some basic rock star math.
Okay.
Your life is over dead now. Every glass memory shattered on the floor. As you walk away by the back door, remember forever, forever December. It's like my heart's been ripped out of my soul, and nothing was in kind of Pacific snow. Remember forever, forever December. First I thought you were teasing me. Said it was hard, but it had to be. And I scream, please don't let me go.
Amazing song, and if you want to hear more of that, you need to hear more of Ivy Blue. Speaking of Ivy Blue, I know you're in New Zealand, and you're not down the street. We're in the Pacific Northwest in the USA, which is up by Canada. You know, I was going to ask you, do you have plans on touring? Do you plan on coming to the States, or?
Well, in terms of touring, we have one show in our hometown this year. That's all that the time really holds, because I've obviously got high school commitments for the majority of the rest of the year. Next year, though, could be different. If we get enough funds, if we can get it together, we will definitely try and get down to the States and everywhere. They're all places we'd like to go, but really, in the end, we've got to make it viable. We've got to make it work. There's no point going out with nothing.
Well,
we want to give people their money's worth.
Who doesn't? Everybody. Every woman I know loves Elvis Presley, whether they're 80 years old or they're 18, or, you know.
That's a good example of having to make your work live on, because Elvis died decades ago. Even though they've got some weird touring hologram, God forbid us doing that. But what the point is that the music lives on. And it keeps going down the generations until we get to generation last, whenever that may be. It's still relevant. It keeps making itself relevant in today's things. That's what a good song and a good album does.
I mean, we're still playing Mozart, and I don't know anybody who knew him.
No. No, that's the good thing about music. It doesn't matter whether the person dies at 27, like Kurt Cobain. It doesn't matter whether they die at 45, like Freddie Mercury, or whenever. As long as you make good music that's going to last years and not just months, then you're on the right track.
You know what? Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. And I got to tell you, it's been such a pleasure having you on. Hopefully, the next time you're on, you know, you'll have, you know, an easier time with us making a connection. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time out early in your morning. I know that, you know, we have not only do we have a time difference, we also have a day difference. So it's a big concession for you guys to make that. And we really, really appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you for the help. And to all your 90,000 friends out there.
Okay.
Check out this station. It's really good. We've had a listen and it sounds great. Also, you can get our music. It started actually this last week. We started doing iTunes sales, and you can get them on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, Spotify, Rito, Deezer, YouTube and your fancy Xboxes if you want. Keep it as low as possible. Hopefully this helps, and all going well, we might be down your way as soon as we can.
We look forward to it, and we'll send you a file, an MP3 file that you can listen to, and then if there's something you want to leave in or take out, you can do that. And so for everyone listening all around the world, you can now listen, on iTunes, and you can listen to on Amazon, which is, one of my favorites. I like Amazon better for some reason, because they have a digital Dolby speakers built into their tablets and things. But, hey, you're everywhere now. You're on your way, man. And maybe I should, have gotten your autograph, a few months ago.
Well, put it this way. We don't mind. We'll do all that. We'll just keep our feet on the ground and not our head in the clouds.
All right. There you go. Thank you so much, and have a great day out there.
No worries. Have a major league day. See you later.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
To learn more about Ivy Blue, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
I used to smoke while my mom's made dinner. Now I smoke rock with Leonard Skinner. No beginners here. I'm a seasoned vet. Educated on jazz by my man. I'm at Earth again, my friend. I've been the world and back. But I'm a Michigan boy. Can you feel that? And I'm home.
Best-selling author Martin Lestraps found success with his debut novel, Inside the Outside, which won the grand prize in the 2012 Paris Book Festival. He is continuing to build on this triumph and shares a few stories in this interview with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Love that guy.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me, Not Stay There. Today, we're really pleased to have on author Martin Lestraps. And he has a wonderful podcast as well. And boy, we're really privileged to have you on. How you doing, Martin?
I'm doing outstanding, and I'm thrilled to be here. So it's nice to hear that you're happy to have me.
We're ecstatic about it, I tell you. There are so many things we want to talk to you about. First of all, let's talk about a little bit about your debut novel, Inside the Outside.
Okay.
You won a grand prize in Paris, and that's just phenomenal.
Yeah, in 2012, it won the grand prize in the Paris Book Festival. It's been about 3 years, and I'm still, I think it's just now settling in a little bit. The success of that book, and honestly, even talking about the success of that book feels weird, because it feels like I'm talking about somebody else's book. It was so surprising, the best possible way you can be surprised, because, I'm an independent publisher, so I put the book out myself, and I remember as clearly as if it was yesterday, I was sitting in the kitchen with my mom in the house that I grew up in. And it was the day before I was going to launch the book. And I was just sitting there with my mom, just feeling very vulnerable and insecure and scared and anxious. So, I needed mom.
Right.
And I remember just telling her, what if nobody cares? What if I put this book out and it just becomes one of another million books out in the marketplace and lives out its life in oblivion? And what if nobody cares? And of course, she was sweet. She's like, well, I'm going to buy it. I was like, why are you going to buy it? What if, put the book out, and then, at that point, it was just kind of like on-the-job training, trying to figure out how do you bring attention to a book? How do people find a book? So to go from that conversation in the kitchen with my mom of what if nobody cares to winning the grand prize in the Paris Book Festival was, I felt like I was in the middle of a Rocky movie.
For me, even though I talk to a lot of authors, and I know a lot of authors, and I read an incredible amount of books, I can't write, it's not a gift that I have.
Mm. Well, for me, I was such a late bloomer. Growing up, I remember pretty clearly second, third grade, right around whenever you start reading, learning how to read and getting those first kind of reader books. I remember testing as a kid in second or third grade, whenever it was, and doing really well my first time around. I mean, I remember learning just, the alphabet and how to write, my name and my address and preschool, things like that. And I always remembered it coming easily to me, but when it came to academics, I was never a great student, and sort of excelling in the classroom was something that never really came easily to me. But when it came to English, I always did well, and I didn't work any harder on that than anything else, but it always came easily to me. But it never occurred to me that because it came easy to me, maybe this is something that I should look into. I just figured, well, if this is easy for me, this is clearly easy for everybody. So it just never occurred to me. And it wasn't until I was 18 and in my first year of college and I took my first English class and did my first essay assignment that that professor, her name is S.K. Murphy. She's a wonderful author. She was the first teacher I had who just kind of took a second to say, you know, you're pretty good at this. You should think about pursuing it. And up until that point, it never even crossed my mind. And at that point in my life, because I was just starting college, I had no idea what the heck I was supposed to do with my life. So I figured, well, this is cool. If I'm good at something, I may as well see this through. And sometimes I wonder, almost I'll wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat thinking, what if I hadn't met that wonderful woman? Would I have ever, you know, investigated this craft that now I can't imagine living without it? I love doing it. It makes me endlessly happy. Even if people stopped reading my books tomorrow, I would still do it because it's something that I so sincerely enjoy. But what if I hadn't met that person? Would I have met somebody else? I have no idea. God, I think about that a lot. I mean, and now, and even as a reader too, because you mentioned that you read a lot. I love reading now, but it was the same thing. I was 18 before I really truly read a book beginning to end, and sort of got it and absorbed it and really felt like I was reading. So up until then, you know, reading was always very mechanical. Like I could read the words on the page, but once I got to the end of the page, I didn't quite have that skill yet of engaging with the words and actually, you know, ciphering the information that was contained in those words. So like today, I'm 37 today, so it's been almost 20 years. But even now, I still feel like I'm catching up with everybody in terms of reading and writing. I probably for the rest of my life, I'll feel like I'm trying to catch up with everybody.
Well, I think that you would have found your voice, as they say in the theater, even if you had met this woman or not. Because obviously the talent and the need to express yourself on a written page was already there. She just, you know, tapped the vein.
I'd like to believe that's true, and I hope it's true, but it probably won't. It won't stop the occasional cold sweats from every now and again.
Well, you know, I can't imagine what that feeling's like, but you know, you did the most important thing, which is you got it out there. You know, it's like, you know, there's a lot of euphemisms and a lot of, you know, sayings, you know, it's like, look, man, you can't win the game if you don't get in it, you know, and by putting the book out there, you opened up yourself, you know, and, you know, allow people to enjoy it or not to enjoy it, you know, and let them draw their own conclusions. I personally think, you know, that books are like, you know, one of the most precious things around. I mean, you could be in a cave and if you got a bunch of books, I mean, you're going to be okay, you know, even movies you're going to grow tired of, you know.
I mean, just literally this morning, I was in my own head having a very similar thought, just thinking about, you know, as much as I love, you know, I love movies and I love television and, you know, I love going on Netflix and getting lost for a couple of hours or whatever. But, if the shit went down and there was some crazy, you know, nuclear attack of some sort and all the technology was destroyed, you couldn't watch movies and you couldn't watch Netflix. And you can't go to the theater. But if you can find a book, you can read that. And that's always going to exist.
Yeah. And the thing about books is, you know, it's a personal thing, you know, because you get to interpret it in your mind any way you want.
Figuratively, I'm laying out a blueprint. And then, you know, you are the engineer with your imagination. You're going to take this blueprint. You're going to create this world. And if I've done a good enough job with this blueprint, you're going to be able to build this really amazing world in your imagination. You can live there for a little while and you can enjoy it and you can go back and revisit it whenever you like.
Yeah, and I think that's really cool that, you know, I've noticed that with a lot of authors, and at least, and for me as a reader, and I think for most readers too, it's like reason people like series so much. If you pick up a book and it's part of a series and you already know some of the characters in it, you feel like you're at home again, you know?
Oh, yeah. You just fall right back into it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same is true for the writer, too. And I've, like on my podcast, I've talked to a couple of writers who've done, you know, book series. You're telling a new chapter in that series, but the characters are created. The setting is established and you get to just sort of, it's like, you know, stepping into a nice, comfortable bath and just sort of, you know, exploring this new story you want to tell.
From a reader's point of view, it's really kind of cool. I mean, you know, at times, you know, it could be like, well, I don't feel like reading that because I know the characters and I pretty much know what the plot's going to be, you know, but then at other times it's like, yeah, it's like, you know, it's like putting on, you know, that comfortable pair of shoes. You're like, yeah, now this feels good.
Even beyond that, you know, if you have a series that people get attached to, you know, they'll come back to it for as long as you want to tell it.
Yeah. So let's talk about your podcast for a little bit. Yeah. How do you like doing it?
I love it, man. It's called the March and Lestrap Show Podcast Hour. Initially, I'm just a fan of the medium. I love podcasts. I listen to podcasts every day. I was literally listening to a podcast right up until 5 minutes before we sat down to talk. Like, I listen to them all the day if I'm on the road, if I'm at home.
Right.
I always have them playing, and I just enjoy it. And the more that I listen to them, I would think, you know, I'm enjoying this. And then sometimes I'd find myself just driving in the car, just having a conversation in my head and realizing I'm not talking to anybody. But I've got these things I want to talk about. It was clear to me that I was drawing inspiration from this medium that, you know, that I think that'd be fun just to sit down and just share my thoughts on this or that or chat with somebody interesting. So I kind of looked into it. My my brother has a lot of experience with in terms of recording. He's been a musician and a composer, and he does commercial jingles and stuff. So I went to him just to find out the technical stuff. Like, if I wanted to do just a podcast for my apartment, nothing crazy, you know, what kind of equipment would I need? How would I get this thing set up? He kind of helped get me set up with that stuff. And then I still remember, you know, not unlike with the Inside the Outside, you know, getting to that moment of like, who the hell even care? Who the hell is gonna, what am I even doing? I'm gonna sit here, talk for an hour, put it out there. Who the hell cares? But I figured just do it anyway, because I figured I love the medium so much. I figured it's got to be fun. I think I'll enjoy it. Beyond just loving the medium, I figured, you know, just in terms of marketing, it would just be one more thing out in the world to help try to bring attention to, you know, to my writing. Because ultimately, whether it's, you know, Twitter, Facebook, my blog, you know, the podcast, you know, whatever it is, you know, just be one more thing that, you know, may or may not bring attention to what I'm doing. Let's see, I think I posted the first episode January of 2014. And with the exception of 1 week, I've posted, one episode every week, without fail. And I'm loving it. And the great thing I found is, I mean, I'll talk to anybody, even though I think I'm sort of at my best when I'm talking to another author, because I feel like I kind of feel like I have something in common with them.
Right.
But man, I really, really love it. And I have no idea if I'm any good at it, to be perfectly honest with you. You know, I'm at the point now where, and I didn't feel like this way early on, because I was still sort of, you know, struggling with all those same insecurities and anxieties that I think anybody would feel when they do something new. But I'm at the point now where, you know, I enjoy it so much that, you know, if the finished product is, it's going to be whatever it's going to be. As long if I enjoyed myself doing it, I'm going to trust that people will enjoy listening to it.
You know, so you like doing the podcast, and what are you working on now, book wise?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's actually a super exciting time for me. So a week ago today, I published book one of my a vampire trilogy. It's called The Vampire and the Hunter Trilogy. Book one is called The Vampire, the Hunter, and the Girl. So that's been out for a week now. And the most exciting thing is, so it launched last Friday. And at the end of its first day, it was the number one best-selling new release in vampire horror on Amazon.com.
Oh, wow. So in these books, in this trilogy, they're available on Amazon.com, right?
Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and iTunes bookstore.
Okay, so are they all e-books?
They're available in e-books, but you can also get them in print books. So if you're like me and you enjoy feeling the heft of a print book in your hand, you can get the print book. And if you dig the digital reading experience, it's available on Kindle and Nook. Like I said, you can get it in the iTunes bookstore. And actually, as I think about it, if anybody's listening and they're interested but they're on the fence, on my website you can sign up for my mailing list. You can go to martinlestraps.com. And if you sign up for the mailing list, you just have to use your name and your email, and I don't bombard you with spam or anything. But if you sign up for the mailing list, then you get chapter one for free. So you get to see if you like it, and if you dig it, then you can go for it and pick up a copy.
That's cool. That's very cool, man. You know, it's been such a blast talking to you, dude. I tell you, you know, I just can't express, you know, how enjoyable this has been. I know our listeners are going to like it, and
it's been absolutely a genuine pleasure on my end, Edward. So thank you so much for having me on the show.
All right. You know what? You'll have to come back on and, you know, continue success.
To learn more about Martin Lestraps and his new book, The Vampire, the Hunter, and the Girl, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
Nightfall. It is dusk on July 17th, 1996. A man and a woman who are married, but not to each other, make love on a Long Island beach as a video camera records their pleasure. And something more. Out over the ocean, TWA Flight 800 suddenly explodes with 230 victims on board, the terrible blast illuminating the sky. The government's verdict is mechanical failure, but the videotape may tell another story, if it can be found. Now, on the fifth anniversary of the crash, two members of the Federal Anti-Terrorist Task Force set out to reopen the case. John Corey, an ex-NYPD detective, and his wife Kate Mayfield, a career FBI agent. Together, they hunt for the crucial video and race toward an elusive truth even more horrifying than the crash itself.
This is a work of fiction based on fact. The crash of TWA Flight 800 that occurred off Long Island, New York on July 17, 1996. The characters in this novel are fictional, though there are passing references to actual persons. The events of July 17, 1996 that I describe in this book and the subsequent investigation of the crash are based on published accounts as well as my own interviews with investigators who worked on this case and my interviews with eyewitnesses to the crash. The official cause of the crash is mechanical failure, though there are conflicting theories that point toward more sinister causes of this tragedy. I've tried to represent all sides of this controversy and to be accurate in regard to the eyewitness accounts, the forensic evidence, and the details of the subsequent investigation. I have, however, taken dramatic liberties and literary license in cases where there is conflicting evidence. This book is in memory of the passengers and crew of TWA Flight 800. Who lost their lives on the evening of July 17, 1996, and to their families and loved ones, as well as to the hundreds of men and women who participated in the rescue and recovery and the subsequent investigations of the cause of this tragedy. Book 1, July 17, 1996, Long Island, New York. For this must ever be a secret, kept from all the rest, between yourself and me. Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland. Chapter 1. Bud Mitchell drove his Ford Explorer along Dune Road. Up ahead was a sign that said Cupsog Beach County Park, open dawn to dusk. It was dusk, but Bud drove through an empty parking field, on the far side of which was a wide nature trail, partially blocked by a roll-up fence. The sign said no vehicles. He said to the woman sitting in his passenger seat, "Are you sure you want to do this?" Jill Winslow replied, "Yes, it's exciting." Bud nodded without enthusiasm. He skirted around the fence and continued on in four-wheel drive along the sandy trail flanked by high, grass-covered dunes. Having extramarital sex should have been exciting enough for both of them, he thought. But Jill didn't see it that way. For her, cheating on her husband was only worth it if the sex, romance, and excitement was better than at home. For him, the taboo of having sex with another man's wife was the turn-on. Somewhere around his 40th birthday, Bud Mitchell had come to the startling conclusion that women were different. Now, 5 years later and 2 years into this affair, he realized that Jill's fantasies and his weren't communicating very well. Still, Jill Winslow was beautiful, willing, and most important, she was someone else's wife, and she wanted to keep it that way.
DeMille's latest is sure to be a number one bestseller. Readers will think about this one for a long time, says Publishers Weekly. Nelson Richard DeMille, a number one New York Times bestselling author, was born in New York City. He was a first lieutenant in the United States Army, 1966 to 69, and saw action as an infantry platoon leader with the 1st Cavalry Division in Vietnam. His first major novel, By the Rivers of Babylon, is still in print, as are all his succeeding novels. He He attended Hofstra University, where he received a degree in political science and history. He lives on Long Island. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
We booked a 7-day cruise on our summer vacation. Ended up lost in this island nation. Saturday morning, a walk in the sand. The rhythmic beat of this tropical band. On the island.
Get Behind Me Now, Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call us at 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sean Mark Nipper.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.
In my head.